Hello and welcome to The Case Files. I'm Kate Chabot, and over the course of this podcast series, I'll be bringing you the true life stories behind some of the UK's most fascinating legal cases, all told with unparalleled access to the people and lawyers closest to events. In this episode, we hear the story of Catherine Pugh, who was in a coach crash in the Alps.
The driver started to shout and he started to say, "I've got no brakes, I've got no brakes."
The crash left her in a coma for months and with some of the most severe burns imaginable.
I only had 4 palms worth of skin that wasn't burnt, and that turned out to be my scalp and the soles of my feet.
After 8 months in hospital at times, she felt like giving up.
That's all I wanted to know. I just wanted to know if I was going to be happy again.
We'll hear how Catherine rebuilt her life with the support of her family, friends and legal team, and with the determination to live every day to the full.
I remember the day I actually went home, which was in the December of 2013. I got in and I remember going to myself, right, this is it. Everything else now is you. You haven't got doctors there, you haven't got nurses there. It's you, it's up to you, you need to do this.
In 2013, Catherine Pugh was 19 years old and had just spent a very happy season in the French Alps, working and skiing. She was on her gap year, enjoying her first taste of freedom and independence before she was due to start university in Manchester. As the ski season came to an end, she was looking forward to returning home to her family in Wrexham. But as she and her friends started the journey back to Britain, the unthinkable happened. The coach was winding its way down a steep mountain when it crashed into a cliffside, changing her life forever.
The driver started to shout and he started to say, "I've got no brakes, I've got no brakes." And I was sat just behind the driver with my boyfriend at the time. And we heard it and were like, what do you mean you've got no brakes? And you could feel the coach start to speed up. And as quickly as it happened, it actually felt like it was, I felt like it took about 20 minutes because of my thoughts and everything that was going on in my head. I was terrified. I could feel that the coach was speeding and I was being shouted these words, "I've got no brakes, I've got no brakes." And then all I could see ahead of me, because we were sat at the front, you know, when you're sat on a coach and you can see a huge window in front of you, all I could see was the valley ahead of me. So we were heading down this road, and there's barriers on the edges so that basically you don't go off the edge of the cliff. And we were heading towards that barrier. That's all I could see. So in my head, I thought we were going off the edge and I thought that'd be it. So I just started thinking, you know, all different kinds of thoughts. I thought about my family. I thought about, I honestly had life flashbacks. And it's very cliche. And people say, oh no, that doesn't really happen. It honestly does. I thought about how much of a nice time I'd had over those 5 months and all of, like, I could just see my mum and dad's faces as we hurtled down this road.
You didn't go off the cliff, did you?
No, so the driver didn't move from his seat, which, I mean, I personally think is heroic, because if you're looking out at that, I can't even imagine when you're in control of that bus how you must feel. And he decided to turn the wheel and it hit the cliff face instead that was next to the barriers. So we ended up going full force into a cliff face instead of going off the edge. If we'd have gone off the edge, I would not be here today. Everyone on that coach would have passed away. So the driver, he died himself on impact. So he basically sacrificed him for all of us. So it was very, very, very brave. And to this day, he'll probably be my biggest hero.
What do you remember immediately after the crash?
When the impact happened, I remember the feeling of the impact. Sean, my boyfriend at the time, had pushed me down into a brace position. So I'd stopped being able to see, but I could feel. And the force of it was so, it was overwhelming. I don't remember this, but everybody else has said that a huge fireball went above everyone's heads. And then everything that I remember is more the noises and the feelings. I think that's probably my brain trying to shut off everything, because I was definitely conscious at that point. I remember the impact, the heat, the sounds of everybody screaming and smashing glasses. I don't know what happened. That's probably the hardest bit for me. I don't know exactly what happened when the crash took place. All I remember is the terror of it all.
Is it right that you didn't
actually feel the pain at first, and it was the reaction of other people that made you realise things were quite serious for you.
Yeah, so I had set on fire, and one of the boys had come back on and got me off the coach. And I remember the pain of being severely burned is a very hard one to describe, because I've since learned it's because it goes through to your nerve ending, so how you feel is affected. But I felt like I was completely numb, but at the same time, my whole body was stinging in a way, which makes no sense because they're opposites. But it was everyone around me. Everyone's eyes looked terrified. Everyone looked terrified, shocked, panicked. And the boys that had got me off and were looking after me on the side of the road, they were covered in blood. And I had no idea at the time that that was my blood. I think I looked down at my arm at one point, or I lifted up my arm when I was away from the coach and on the side of the road waiting for the paramedics. And I remember it was all different colours, black and red and yellow and orange, and my skin wasn't where it should be. And I remember seeing that and going, oh no, something awful has happened. But I honestly had no idea that my whole body was in that same condition.
So just how badly injured were you?
So it was 96% full thickness burns or third degree burns. So this is how I always describe it. I'm not from a medical background, so when I was told this, I had no idea. But when you are measuring a burn on a patient, 1% of body area is equivalent to the patient's palm, like the skin on the patient's palm. So for me, I only had 4 palms worth of skin that wasn't burnt. And that turned out to be my scalp and the soles of my feet. But everywhere else was full thickness, so through every layer of skin and down to the nerve endings, which the outcomes usually are not good for that kind of injury.
The expressions on the faces of the other passengers on the coach told Katrin that her injuries must be very serious.
I knew, because of everybody else's reactions, that it was bad. I didn't know why, and I didn't know how much, but I knew something bad had happened. And all these paramedics, I was like the sole person that they were focused on. So I knew that it was not going to be good. So I assumed if I fell asleep or they knocked me out that I wasn't going to wake up again. I knew it was bad enough that I could die because of the look on everyone's faces.
Were you panicking?
I was, but I also was extremely calm. Everyone that I've spoken to since, because I remember it, but obviously it's been such a long time. Like, I don't know where memories have blurred into dreams and what's maybe even made up in my head and things. So when I speak to other people that were there, they say, like, I was just lay there silently and I was asking questions and I was saying, am I okay? What's going to happen? Can you contact my mum and dad? I was saying all these things, but I wasn't screaming. I wasn't crying. Everyone deals with shock and panic in different ways. I clearly just went into this very calm state where I knew that something was bad and I knew that crying and screaming for me wasn't going to make me feel better. I panicked the final 10, 15 minutes when they were trying to put me out and put a mask on my face. And that's when fight or flight really kicked in, and I basically fought the paramedics, which was probably the silliest idea I've ever had.
Katrin was sedated at this point, but she has now pieced together what happened. Initially, only her mother and her brother flew out to France, as her family weren't aware of the true extent of her injuries. Doctors later told her mother Katrin's chances of survival were just 1 in 1,000.
When my mum arrived at the airport in Lyon, she was met by the British consul, and she said from that moment she knew that it was not good. So she was taken to the hospital, met by the doctors. The doctors couldn't speak very much English. And she said that was really hard, but basically the doctor put his thumb and his index fingers together and said a little chance, a very little chance of living.
Her family were told she would get better care in the UK, but no one was sure that she would survive the journey. They made the agonising decision to try, and it was touch and go throughout. She was still unconscious, but her injuries were so severe that being in a coma was crucial to her survival. Once back in the UK, the surgeons kept her in the coma to allow them to carry out many of the hundreds of operations she needed to help heal her burns. She was in the coma for 3 months.
In my eyes, I just had a little nap for 3 months. It was the worst bit for everybody involved, except for me. That's what, how I always describe it, because I was still, during that coma, on the brink of will she, won't she survive? And it was like that for a couple of months, so...
How many times was it critical that you might actually pass away? Do you have any idea?
So my parents said that on intensive care, there was a room that you were taken into. And if you were taken into that room, it meant it was usually quite bad news. And they were taken into that room 3 times. The first was when I was admitted and they were told what the surgeons thought they could do, what my chances were, and whether they were going to give it a go. And all of those things were... They wanted to operate. My chances are very slim, but they were going to give it a go. The second and the third time were both points in my recovery when my health took a real turn. And they
got an infection, didn't you, at one point?
Yeah, so I got quite... You often will get infections. With the kind of injury I had, you're prone to them. So I got quite a few during my time, but there was 2 significant ones where... My parents were basically called in and told that they shouldn't go home because the chances of me making it through the night, again, were very, very slim. It was a very long time in that coma. And the coming out of it, as I said, was really slow, really thought out and planned. My memories are hazy from that time of waking up, to be honest with you, because I'd wake up for a couple of minutes and fall back asleep, or wake up for 10 minutes and fall back asleep. So in my mind, it all kind of melds. I asked my mum what she remembered before coming over today, and she said all she remembers is when I used to open my eyes, because I'd been in bed for such a long time and the scarring on my face had meant I couldn't put my lips together, so I was having to just have an open mouth most of the time, and I was ventilated so I couldn't speak. She said all you used to do was look at me in desperation and try and mouth things to me, and she said that again, for her, was really hard because all she wanted to do was know what I was feeling and knew what I was trying to say, being there.
And after you actually came out of the coma, what was it like for the first few months, mentally and physically?
Coming out of a coma and waking up to that reality was awful. I had been 19, young, independent, and I woke up in a hospital bed. I had... leads and wires coming out of everywhere.
Did you know what had happened when you actually woke up?
So I was told, again, over a sort of a period of time, I was told multiple times because it didn't really sink in. I mean, how do you tell someone that? How do you tell someone how awful their new reality is? I couldn't do anything. Like, I woke up, and because I'd had complications with neurological problems and I'd had all these operations, I was completely dependent on everyone. I couldn't do anything for myself. Yeah, I remember being told it, but I remember it being a very long process. And I don't think it really sunk in until probably about 5 or 6 months after the accident, when I was becoming actually aware of just how hard life was going to be from that point.
Can you describe how you are? You've had, 200 plus procedures when you were in the coma. You had 96% burns on your body. I understand your eyes have been affected. Just describe how you are and how you look today.
So after the burns, I think lots of people may have seen burn survivors. I don't know if you, Katie Piper, is someone in this public eye that had a burn. I've been left with very similar scarring all over my body. So I have very significant scarring. Which can be difficult because it makes me look very different. But I now embrace them, which is great. I have issues with my hands. So as a complication of how severe the burns were, I ended up having my fingertips on one of my hands amputated. So it's a smaller hand, but it's a lot. It's actually my strongest hand, funnily enough, which people never, ever assume. And then my other hand, because of the neurological problems, is in a kind of clawed position all the time. So that makes life a bit more tricky. As you said, my eyes were affected. So because I was so ill, I lost oxygen and blood to my brain on multiple occasions when I was very, very ill and had those infections. And because of that, I ended up, my optic nerve was damaged. So I've ended up with something called ischemic optic neuropathy. Basically, I don't have any central vision left. So my peripheral vision is intact, but my central vision, so the vision you use to spot someone when you're walking down the street or to read a sign or to, I don't know, read a bus number, I don't have that vision. But yeah, otherwise, I like to think I still look quite like I used to look. And I do have other complications, like I have mobility issues and sensation problems, and I struggle my skin because of all the skin grafts. Like I struggle with feeling temperature, and I can't feel if someone touches my calf, I wouldn't feel it. So I have all these things, and I often brush over them because it's just, it's my day to day now, so I forget about it. But yeah, I like to think I've got back to almost like I was before, but I don't actually want to be the person I was before. I call it like the new normal. I'm for the new normal now. And yeah.
What was it like when you saw yourself in the mirror for the first time?
When you have a burn, you just assume that it's going to be gruesome 24/7. And it was. When I was in intensive care, they used to take me for baths. And actually, one of my most vivid memories on waking up from the coma was the first ever bath I had, because it was like a 15-person operation. They used to have anaesthetists there, my surgeon would be there, multiple nurses, people holding each limb, all of this. And I remember seeing my body for the first time then, not my face, but just my body. And I was terrified. I remember seeing it, and there was stitches and staples holding pieces of skin together. Mm. And it was bloody, and it was very gory. And it's kind of what I'd pictured in my mind when everyone was saying, you've had burns and you've had all these operations. Seeing my face for the first time in the mirror, because of that and because of that experience, actually, because I didn't see my face until about 5 months after the accident, I built it up in my head that my face was going to look the same as everywhere else did. But they'd done my face so much earlier on that actually it healed up quite nicely. So the first time I saw myself in the mirror was not as bad as I thought it was going to be. And also it was done in a very organised way. Like my mum was there, I had a nurse there. It was very calm, and there was like a psychologist there and everything. What I found harder was actually going forwards. I would go out in the hospital in my wheelchair, with my mum would push me down to just get me out of my room. And in the lifts, there used to be mirrors at the back of the lift. And I remember we'd go down to the base floor, and my mum would try and pull me in backwards so I couldn't see myself. But I would always catch a glance. That used to be harder because I'd have forgotten that I looked different. And I think that for me in the beginning was the hardest bit. I'd forget that I looked different, and I'd assume that I'd have hair because they shaved all my hair off to use the skin from my scalp. I just assumed I'd have hair, and I assumed in my head that I was who I was before. And when you forget that and then you see the reality, it can be quite hard.
What were the bad days like?
The bad days were really bad. And to be honest, most of my hospital time was a bad day. I used to cry every single day when I was in hospital. And I feel like it was, people forget when you go through a traumatic accident and you end up with such a massive change to the way you look, your abilities, you have to grieve, and you've had a massive loss. People don't think about it like that. I didn't think about it like that to begin with. But looking back, I was starting the grieving process of exactly what I've lost. So it was awful. Like, and I couldn't see how anybody after this kind of accident could ever have a life that was happy. I used to say to my parents, it would have just been easier if I'd have passed away. I used to say it would be easier if I died, because for you it'd be easier, because you wouldn't have me as a burden, like, because that's the way I used to see myself when I was in hospital. And I was like, and also for me it would be easier because I wouldn't be in pain. I wouldn't have all these memories of what had happened. I wouldn't have all of this.
Did you want to die ever?
Absolutely. Yeah. When I was in hospital, I said on multiple occasions, I want to. I think it'd be odd if I hadn't thought that, considering the severity of everything.
Did you have counselling?
So I had a psychologist right at the beginning come in, and a counsellor. I actually refused to see them. It's a very, very ridiculous reason why, but at the time it made sense. It was a really, really lovely young girl. She was probably like in her late 20s, 30s. She was really lovely. She'd spoken to my brother and my mum because they'd both gone in for operations to donate their skin to me. They really liked her. She was so nice. But in my eyes, I remember her coming in and she was really pretty and had lovely hair and would always be dressed really nice. And I'd just sit there and think, I am not speaking to you because you do not understand. I didn't need that at that point. I needed to speak to people, but I used to speak to like my mum, my dad, my sister, my brother, all the nurses. But I actually didn't have counselling or psychology input probably for like a year and a half, 2 years by choice. Because I wanted, and I still believe, that you should engage when you're ready. The time I spoke to someone, because I had also decided that I wanted it, I felt more in control of it. I lost control completely when this all happened. So anything I could kind of get control back on made a big difference.
So when did things start to, I mean, what made the difference between you and on the one hand, you didn't want to carry on fighting? What changed?
The continual support from everyone around me was probably the only reason that kept me going. The thing that got me to fight was meeting other burn survivors when I was in hospital. I was really struggling with engaging with physiotherapy, occupational therapy, seeing anyone, basically, and doing what I was told.
You being a difficult patient.
I was being a very difficult patient. And I think I was like 19, so I was kind of on the brink where I wasn't really an adult, but I wasn't a kid. The team at hospital thought it would be a good idea to get some people in to try and motivate me. So there was a lady who'd come in to the hospital with burns, to the same hospital, treated by the same team, about 10 years before I had. She, I think, had had like 80% burns, so very significant. Again, people don't survive that usually, so it was really similar. She was from a similar area, all of these things, and it had happened to her when she was about 20, I think. So I had all these sort of parallels with her. I remember her walking in, she was in a dress, tight, she had a tattoo on her leg. This is so silly that I remember all these things. But she had a tattoo on her leg, her hair looked great, and she came in and she was so vibrant and talked to me about how awful and how she understood how bad it was, that she was working, she'd been married twice, she lived in a house and she drove and she was independent. And I think my last question to her was just, are you happy? Because that's all I wanted to know. I just wanted to know if I was going to be happy again. And I remember her saying yes. And that for me was like a turning point. Seeing her and seeing that you could go through this awful situation and you could come out the other side and still be happy, still be independent, still maybe not live the life you planned on living, but still live a very worthwhile life. That made me want to fight. And that was about a month before I went home. So from that day, I really tried. And I remember the day I actually went home, which was in the December of 2013, I got in and I remember going to myself, right, this is it. Everything else now is you. You haven't got doctors there. You haven't got nurses there. It's you. It's up to you. You need to do this. And from that day, like I went for it. And luckily, because I had that attitude and I was able to sort of summon up that like resilience and determination, I was able to come through the way I have. And I'm now at that place that I wanted to know all about, that place where I was happy. I'm very, very happy now. And I could never have imagined that years ago.
Katrin's resilience and willpower were clearly crucial to her recovery, but she also had the support of friends and family, as well as a large legal team from Slater and Gordon, who worked to win a settlement from the coach company. Katrin's parents became clients while she was still in a coma. Katrin says the legal process was difficult at times, having to relive her horrific ordeal in order to gather evidence. But it was crucial in making sure her future was secure.
One of the longest processes I've ever done, probably, but one of the most beneficial processes for my life and for my peace of mind for the future.
Because they admitted liability, didn't they?
Yeah, so they admitted liability, and it was the fault of the coach. The coach, there was a fault with the brakes. The way I see it is, it's security for my future. And my parents, they were terrified about what would happen to me. They didn't know if I'd be able to work, if I'd be able to study. Obviously, now, like, because I'm who I am and I've made the recovery I have, I do have options, but they are limited. And I make out like I'm independent, I'm in London, it's really great. There are a lot of adaptations I need, like my eyes, like I have to use special equipment for my eyes, for everything I do. My house, like I have to have change. So it's making sure that all of these things can be in place in the future for me, no matter what happens. And for my parents particularly, they now know that they can rest easy because they don't have to worry about me.
The legal team was successful in securing interim payments very quickly, which helped get Catherine the treatments she needed. One of the people working on her case was Nicola Rostron.
We were able to secure a voluntary interim payment for Catherine quite early on in the initial stages of the case. And that was particularly important because that allowed us to fund the pivotal rehabilitation for Catherine. It was a multidisciplinary approach, lots of rehabilitation, which included physiotherapy, occupational therapy, hand therapy, orthotics. There were so many things and different angles that we wanted to look at. And it was really important that we could get that at the very, very beginning to start that long process of recovery. Getting the interim payment also meant that we could fund this rehabilitation on a private basis, so we didn't have to have Catherine waiting on very long waiting lists.
That was what the alternative would have been, was
yes.
it?
Yes. We appointed a case manager, which is somebody who coordinates the rehabilitation. It would have been too much for Catherine and her family with the emotional distress that they were already going through to put all of that onto Catherine's parents. So that was something that the case manager could do to coordinate these things for Catherine.
And can you give me an idea of some of the things that's helped pay for? What kind of treatments has she needed?
Yes. In terms of treatment, as I've already highlighted, it was multidisciplinary in nature. So the treatment included physiotherapy, hand therapy, orthotics, aids, adaptations, all little things that when taken together would make Catherine's life better. Adaptations to the property, so for example, installation of a wet room. The experts, just going back to that for one moment, the number of experts we had, there were 17 experts in total in this case. Now, a lot of those were medical experts, but there was also non-medical experts as well. So we even had a dietitian involved because Catherine lost so much weight following all of the surgery. We wanted to make sure that we looked at every aspect of her injuries.
Slowly, all the work of this team of professionals alongside Catherine's determination began to generate results. Catherine told me about one of the milestones in her recovery.
I went into hospital one day, saw my surgeon, and he literally said, "So have you walked yet, Catherine?" And I was like, absolutely not. Of course I haven't. No, I'm still on my wheelchair, Mr. James, please. And he looked at me and he went, "I reckon you can do it. Come on, let's have a go. Let's see if you can do it." And I was like, "Honestly, I don't want to do it. I can't do it." And he went, "I'm going to stand here. I want you to stand up." And he was like, "They'll help you stand up." And then he was like, "And I want you to take 3 steps and I'll catch you if you fall over." And I was terrified. But he stood maybe like 2 metres away from me and he just put his arms out and said, "Walk to me." And I took 3 steps and then I fell on him. And then from then, like again, once I could see I could do it, there was no stopping me. So I got home and I took steps, like 5 steps in the living room and fell on the sofa. And then I started doing it bit by bit and slowly and slowly. And they weren't great. My mum used to say, I don't know if you remember the puppets, the Thunderbirds, how they used to walk. They used to walk like that when I first started, so really high legs and my arms everywhere.
What was the rehab process like?
Very, very, very long. So they started rehabbing me in hospital, obviously.
Do you still need it now?
So a burn survivor will probably always need some kind of physio and rehab. The kind of scarring I have, it can get really tight. So one of the main reasons you do rehab and physio going forwards is to prevent any contractures and any tightness. Because if I have that, that means more operations. I had a lot to rehab. It was not just my walking. I couldn't even like flicker my thumb didn't even have a flicker in it. I could maybe ever so slightly pinch, but not really. So there was a lot to do. I had to get my hands going, my body going, my legs going, my feet, my ankles, everything.
And what effect has all of this had on your family and your relationships with them?
Going through this traumatic event, it obviously affected me, and everyone always knows about how it affects me because, I mean, it's on my skin. You can see that it affected me. I think families get forgotten about in the sense of how much it can impact on them. My family were so impacted. My mum still like doesn't really sleep because she waits for that phone call to say that something's happened at hospital. It's awful. So for them, it's been very, very hard. They have honestly been the most supportive, amazing network that I could have had during this time. And I've been lucky enough to be one of those families where it's actually made us a lot closer.
What about your mental health? Do you have post-traumatic stress disorder? Do you have flashbacks and problems with anything in particular as a result?
So how I was affected with PTSD was mainly flashbacks. So I was okay for quite a while. And then when I had a lot to focus on, so I was busy all the time having all this input and physical input. So my head, I personally put to one side and just thought, I'll deal with that later. When all that dwindled and I realised maybe I needed some help with psychology and things, it was because at that time I had less to focus on. So these flashbacks started coming. So my particular triggers were things like seeing fire on TV, and I really struggled with getting on buses and coaches for a very long time. I mastered buses eventually, and then the only reason I got on a coach was because I went travelling in Australia, and the only way to get up the coast was on a coach, to do it cheaply. So so I had to get on one.
That must have been hard.
It was awful. Yeah, it was hard. I was with my sister, so that's why I knew I could do it. But I really had to build myself up for it. And I had like my little regime. So I sat where I knew I wanted to sit. So I tried to sit opposite the fire exit. And I made sure that I didn't fall asleep. So I'd never, ever slept on the coaches. So on our 17-hour bus journey, I was wide awake the whole time and alert. I also, when I do things like go on a coach, I always carry a travel break the glass hammer. My friend got me one as a birthday present as a joke a while ago, but for the first time I was like, I'm gonna take it just in case because it might make me feel a bit better. But yeah, it was really hard. But so yeah, getting on coaches and buses have always triggered flashbacks. Not anymore. Like, I've managed to gaining control is probably the best word, gain control of it. And fire, the flashbacks I used to have, I have a memory in my head of seeing the driver on fire. I don't know if that is a memory I actually have, or if it's a memory that I have conjured. I honestly don't know. But I used to see that quite often. It would just pop up in the front of my mind and I would just see it. It's really hard to describe,
what
though.
What did that do to you when you saw that?
It's really scary because it wasn't like I was there again. It was more just that I could see this image projected in my brain. And it would make my heart rate, like, it would make me feel panicked. It would never last for longer than like 1 or 2 minutes. But it just, not that it put me there, but it made me have all those feelings of like, what's going on?
And is that stopped now?
Yeah, so I had a therapy called EMDR therapy. I don't know what that means. it's something to do with eye movement.
Yes.
And it's particularly good for post-traumatic stress disorder and flashbacks. So I had that, and I had quite a long course of it, and it was beneficial for me. Mm. I found it really helpful, and the flashbacks lessened.
This happened to you, the accident, when you were on your gap year, and now, after all this time, you are studying at last.
Yeah, finally. My mum and dad are elated. They're very overjoyed that I'm finally at uni. It's just 8 years late. Yeah, so I started working with charities, and I realised I wanted to help, didn't know how. And I got inspired by all of the amazing healthcare team that I experienced in hospital. So I knew that I wasn't really interested in nursing. I didn't think I'd want to be a doctor, and I was like, I really liked having physiotherapy and occupational therapy, and obviously I'd had that much input over my life. I felt like I knew a few things. So I started a college course so that I could get the right grades to get into uni, and then I started university in September 2018, and I'm studying physio. I moved to London, and yeah, it's definitely not the life I thought I would be having, but it's a really wonderful, wonderful life.
Catherine's friends have been a key support for her.
They have been there every step of the way. They're the people that are behind me when I walk down the street and I've got my arms on show and my scars out, and they're behind me to make sure if anything were to happen, they'd be there. I live with my best friend now, and I'm still really, really close friends with a lot of the people from the crash as well. So I think when you go through something like that, the bond, it never breaks. I have a lot of people around me. I'm very lucky to have lots of people who are supportive and understanding and have been there pretty much every step of the way.
Anyone special?
Not at the moment. I'm on the hunt, though.
Seen anyone since the crash? Or?
Not really. So when we had the accident, I was with my boyfriend. He was there, he was amazing afterwards. Like, he saved me. He was the one that pulled me off the coach. I've got a very high pedestal that I put men on now, because he literally saved my life. He was there every step of the way. And then in the end, I was the one that was like, I've got so much going on. I need to sort myself out before I can do anything else. And we've remained friends, and that's definitely not something that will change now. The thing is, I live in an age where you go to a pub and people don't really walk up to each other anymore and say, hi, you're lovely, do you want to go for a drink? Everything is Tinder and Bumble and all these dating apps, which is hard enough to navigate anyway. And when you look different, it makes it a lot harder, because literally everyone swipes on these things based on a picture. And I don't think it's fair, but that's just the world I live in now. So I've dated a bit, but I also have a lot on. I keep saying this to my mum. My mum's like, so when are you going to bring someone home? And I'm like, well, at the moment, I don't actually know if I'll have any time. London's too fun a city to be doing that.
Have you had any bad experiences of the way people out and about have reacted towards you?
The main thing I get is staring, pointing, people turning to their friends and talking
saying
about
something.
Me. And then
how do you deal with it?
In my eyes, I always go to myself, they're just uneducated, they don't understand. And I try and say to myself, and everyone's different with how they cope, I try and say to myself, if something came down the street that looked different, I don't know, like a pink car in a sea of black cars, you would take a glance. So when people take a glance at me, I remember that and I really try and focus on it, because it helps me feel okay about it. I'd say I'm good 95% of the time, but there's always going to be that 5% where I go home and I feel rubbish about it. Going out's quite hard. So obviously I like going out with my friends and socialising, and I'm quite happy to wear a little dress, have my scars out, and, you know, my hands aren't something I can necessarily hide, and they look very different. So when people have had a drink or they're out having fun, that's usually when I get more comments, and it's things like, oh, what happened to you? Or why do you look like that?
Does that bother you?
It doesn't anymore. Well, I remember when it first happened, I was quite taken aback and off my guard, because I wasn't expecting it. Now I know I'm strong enough to answer them, A.
Would you rather they said nothing?
I don't think I'd rather they said nothing. I personally, because I'm very confident and quite good at handling it, in my head, I think, if I can answer them, they've said it to me, and I can give them a really strong answer and say, this has happened naturally, and it's got nothing to do with you, but hopefully next time you meet someone, you won't be saying that same question. Hopefully that means that they won't be doing it to a more vulnerable person where that comment tips them over the edge that day.
Catherine is an ambassador for the charity Changing Faces, which works with people who have scars or marks that make them look different. The charity has just launched a campaign aimed at reducing the bullying and harassment of people with disfigurements. Catherine Deacon is the charity's director of fundraising and communications. She told me that research carried out as part of the campaign shows the extent of the problem.
One in four people with a disfigurement experience a hate crime. And 1 in 10 will experience things like repeated harassment on social media. So we know the scale of the problem that our community is facing is huge. But we know still that despite this high incidence of hate crime amongst our community, we're still not seeing the reporting. So only 1 in 5 feel confident enough to report it. So the campaign is to raise awareness within our community about their rights, but equally to say to people, you know, this behaviour is just simply unacceptable and it needs to stop. To give you a sense of the experiences that some of our community are facing, we've heard from one of our champions how he was on a bus once and someone came up to him, used abusive language and stuck chewing gum in his hair. We've had experiences of people being in cars with their family members and someone sticking a mobile phone through and taking a photo without permission. We've had experiences of people walking down the street and getting, without any prompt or interaction, abusive language shouted after them. Those are the day-to-day experiences that our community are facing. And it really ranges from, you know, that day-to-day grind of comments and stares right through to really significant incidents.
How do you advise someone to cope with that?
So we don't think that people with a disfigurement should have to cope with that. And there is a high level of resignation within our community in just that, oh, this is just what happens. It isn't good enough. So we really encourage anyone with a disfigurement that's experienced any kind of abuse and harassment to report it, whether that's to a police or a third party reporting agency. And if they're struggling in terms of emotionally how that's making them feel, Changing Faces is here to provide that emotional support. So I'd encourage them to visit our website or go and ring our information line as well.
How do you think anyone should react if they meet someone with a disfigurement? What do they need to do? Because the natural curiosity of a human being is to look at things that are different. What would you advise someone to do?
So I think that's absolutely right. I mean, the natural reaction might be to take a double take or look, but it's really to treat them with the same respect and courtesy you would treat anyone. And there are various kind of coping tips. And actually, we have some really good advice on our website about this. So, you know, smile, make eye contact, listen to what they're saying. I mean, we had one of our champions, Richard, who said when he goes into meetings or goes to interviews, he knows for the first 5 minutes when he's talking, he needs to discount anything he's said to people because they're just staring at his face. So it's really, you know, take the time to smile, make eye contact, and just engage with someone like anyone else, really.
As well as working for charities and training to be a physiotherapist, Catchen was asked to model for the cosmetics company Avon. She told me what that was like.
It was an amazing experience. Like, I was there with all different kinds of people, and it was just nice to feel like I could be part of that, because I personally have always found it hard looking at images, whether it's advertising or whether it's in magazines or whatever. And I've honestly never, ever in the last 7 years seen anyone with burn scarring unless it is to tell the story of the burns. Mm. To have me in the campaign with no words around it, nothing, it's just a picture. How powerful is that if someone sat at home in that position I was sat in, where I didn't want to do anything and I felt so low, and they see themselves represented. Mm. That's why I do it. That's why I say yes to being a model and going on television and doing these things. I do enjoy it, but I do it because I know that I would have needed to have heard it and I wish I'd heard it 7 years ago.
If you could just sum up how you see things now in terms of what happened, how you see yourself now and how you envisage your future, what would you say briefly?
My life is not what I expected it to be when I was 18 years old, but my life is probably more fulfilling than I ever could have imagined. My hopes for the future are that I can continue working with the charities that helped me and that I can continue helping others, that I can work as a physiotherapist, hopefully. My ideal dream would be to work with burns patients in the future in a physiotherapy capacity and in a charity capacity. And no, like, people are like, do you really want to make your life about that? And the thing is, I wear my scars on my skin. My burns are literally on me for people to see. So I'm never going to be able to get away from it. So if I can take control and take the reins and I can tell it my way and do it my way, to me, that's a lot of power, and it's worth going through everything I've been through. So it looks very bright. I think my future looks bright, and I hope that as long as I'm happy and everyone that I love is healthy, then I'm quite good.
Catherine Pugh, it's been great speaking to you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks to Nicola Rostron from Slater and Gordon and Catherine Deakin from Changing Faces. But most of all, thanks to Catherine Pugh for telling us her unforgettable story. If you want to know more, have a look at our website, slatergordon.co.uk/podcast, or head over to our social media channels and search hashtag CaseFilesPod and join the conversation. In our next episode, we hear from a man caught up in the 2017 Westminster Bridge terror attack. I'm Kate Chabot. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye for now.